I've got dreams, dreams to remember. I've got dreams, dreams to remember. Honey, I saw you there last night. Another man's arms holding you tight. Nobody knows what I feel inside. All I know, I walked away and cried. I've got dreams.
This is Comics Therapy, episode 40. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, two comics from April 30th, 2014. Dream Police number one and Bad Dreams number one. As always, we have your nerd confessions, and on the couch, we welcome writer Joe Harris. As a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so consider this your spoiler warning.
Hi, this is Adam Ford calling from Australia with a nerd confession about Dream Creator team-ups. I think I'd really like to see Neil Gaiman and Steve Ditko get together. I think it would work on a lot of levels. I think Ditko and Gaiman would do an amazing collaboration on a comic like Doctor Strange or The Creeper. I think those are Ditko's two weirdest, surrealist comics that don't descend too much into the polemic that he tended towards in later career, and current career too, to be honest. I think Gaiman would write a fantastic Creeper story. I think he'd play really interestingly with the psychology of the character of the Creeper. And also, I think, you know, I think the magical world of Doctor Strange is ready-made for Neil Gaiman. I don't know if he's ever actually written any Doctor Strange before, but I think he'd do a great job. I think Ditko's work on Creeper and Doctor Strange were some of the best work that he did in his career to date. And I think also it'd be a great pairing because I know that Neil Gaiman is actually a massive Steve Ditko fan. There was a documentary a few years ago called In Search of Steve Ditko, where a UK television host and Neil Gaiman went and tracked down Ditko at his office in New York and actually went inside to meet him. They weren't allowed to take cameras in, but they both came out grinning like grinning like 8-year-old boys who'd just been in a comic shop with autographed zines that had been given to them by Ditko himself. So yeah, that's my dream team nerd confession. Sorry for rambling a little, but yeah, I want to see Ditko and Gaiman working on something together. And let's face it, they're both alive, they're both still making comics, so let's make it happen. Thanks for an excellent podcast. I'm looking forward to tuning into the next episode. See you guys.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. Certainly this week, neither of us are great role models on the topic. Our theme, as you may have guessed, is sleep. Specifically the kind of sleep where dreaming is possible, if not inevitable. Everybody dreams. But through thousands of years of speculation and study, we're no closer to really understanding why we do or what they mean. Dreams in fiction have a special power all their own, often exploring the more surreal aspects of this shared experience we have no control over. It all comes down to how much you trust your ability to stay safe within your own subconscious.
Aaron, Andrea, you may be full up, but in case you're looking for any other comic dream teams, Mark Waid and Jerry Ordway on Superman 52 type book in the vein of Batman 66. And speaking of Batman 66, having Tom Pyre and Ty Templeton as the permanent team on that book. You know what I'm saying?
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions, answering life's deepest geeky questions and celebrating what we love and what we snark about comics. This week we asked for your comics dream team. See what we did there? Of artists, writers, and or colorists working together on your dream book. Every week you can call, Skype, or email your confessions to us. The details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. Remember, catharsis is cool.
A 1, 2, 3... There's something here doesn't last too long.
Mr. Todd Rundgren with a rock classic from 1972. You're listening to the Comics Therapy Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Silva. My co-host, Roderick Ruth, can't be here today. He's visiting a distant planet, a place he tells me is called Texas. We're talking about Dream Team creators on the show today, and one of my dreams came true just this past week, Southern Bastards by Jason Latour and Jason Aaron. Latour has been one of my favorite creators since I read Loose Ends a couple years back. Issue 1 through 3 is in print, and 4 comes out later this year. Loose Ends is Latour's grit-lit Southern Noir. My LCS guru suggested I read it. Another point in that cat's column. I bought everything Latour has put out since, and even combed through a few long boxes to get my Latour on. Latour is the cartoonist and colorist on Southern Bastards. Jason Aaron handles the writing duties. If you know Jason Aaron, but not Jason Latour, that's okay. You will. You most definitely will. Southern Bastards is every Martin Scorsese movie about desperate men living in a world of testosterone and bad decision-making rolled into a David Mamet play. This is sure to be one hell of a book going forward. My favorite part might be the afterwards by both creators. Points to Jason Aaron for name-checking Faulkner. So like the moth to the flame, the Myers to the LCS, pour yourself a mint julep, load up your ass pocket with some whiskey, and head on down to that pit of arrested development and knuckle draggers you call your local comic shop. Unless, of course, you shop at Legend Comics and Coffee in Omaha, Nebraska. That place is swell. Pick yourself up a copy of Southern Bastards, and while you're at it, get Loose Ends. Latour is a smart writer, and the art by Chris Bruner and Rico Renzi is slick, sweet, and dirty, dirty, dirty. And now, a word from our sponsors.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter at Andrea Schock and Aaron at Aaron Myers. The show account is at Comics Therapy. So, Aaron, who's your dream team?
Michael Jordan on the Bulls in, what, 94?
Round about there.
Something like that, right?
Yeah, something like that.
That was the dream team.
I remember the Cups at, I don't know, whatever fast food restaurant was sponsoring that particular Olympics.
Oh, was it the Olympics?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the Bulls?
No, it was a really big deal because it was the first time that professional athletes were allowed to play.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. So that's my answer. Michael Jordan writing and Larry Bird on pencils.
Okay.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar on inks.
I think you're all over the place. Why don't we talk about comics?
Well, you have to answer the question too.
I know, but I asked you first.
Okay. The problem is I only have the answer that would make us angry, which is sort of like a non-answer, because I would want to pick the writer. So like say somebody like Brian K. Vaughan or something.
Okay.
And then an artist that we didn't know about. I like the undiscovered talent that blows our mind.
Okay.
Because for me, like these dream team questions are, I don't want the expected in a way. So if you say like, oh, you know, Grant Morrison and Frank Quietly, then we're expecting All-Star Superman. Oh. But if we're saying Grant Morrison and this dude who lives in the Ukraine and has been in Gulag for 20 years, but look at this art, then it's like we don't have expectations. We're just...
Like Felipe Andrade, I don't know how to say his last name, and Jordi Belair when they did Captain Marvel was like a revelation because it was unexpected and nobody had seen his work before.
Yeah, that's a good example. Yeah.
Still my favorite... art team on that book, by the way.
Well, thanks for hijacking my answer.
Well, I was just trying to give you an example that could help you come up with the right answer.
That is a answer that we've come up together with, and that's a collaboration. This is a Dream Team podcast.
I didn't think about this at all. I didn't think about the answer. I didn't prep a...
You knew when we were recording, right?
I did. I've been a little busy.
Have you?
I have. Been a little busy, a little frazzled, not sleeping too well.
So you don't have an answer for this at all?
I think the problem is that it can turn quickly into like a greatest hits answer. Like, oh, my favorite writer and oh, my favorite artist. And let's put them together and see what they come up with.
Sure. Which I don't think always works either when we have these like this would be, you know, this guy's my favorite writer and this guy's my favorite artist if they work together, because it seems like the more we talk to creators, those situations come up in Marvel and DC because that's work for hire. It's like, okay, you're going to write it and then we'll pass it off to this guy.
Sure.
And sometimes, you know, a lot of the time that works pretty well, but then you just have disaster books when you have really good creative teams that just, because the relationship doesn't work. Or for a myriad of reasons, but I think that's a possibility, you know?
Can I answer thematically as opposed to specifically? Just using the example that I threw out for Captain Marvel as a kind of general guideline, I would, and this is, this is silly, but Jesse Hamm was talking yesterday about some actual artist influences, or I don't even know if they're necessarily influences of his, but he mentioned John Singer Sargent, and I threw out Shelley as a kind of counterexample of these fucking phenomenal figure artists from the early 20th century who have a very expressionistic style that I would love to see more influence in, like a more traditional superhero book, like what happened with Captain Marvel in that middle run. So I'm not going to give you necessarily specific examples of my actual dream artist, but man, I would certainly like to see more of that on that kind of more traditional superhero story. I actually appreciate that, breaking out of the mold of what would normally be kind of a house style. And I think Marvel's doing that with a bunch of books. And we've talked about that a bit. So it's I'm not going to say it's a cop-out answer. It's a bit of a cop-out answer. But I just stylistically, I would be like all over that right now.
I wonder how, but it, you know, it's things like these things swing in directions from time to time. It's like, if you look back, you know, the 90s are so kind of ingrained in my comics consciousness, so it's easy to tap kind of into.
Of course.
But, like, you know, if you look at a lot of 90s comics, they're it's not a well-loved time for mainstream comics in terms of anatomy and style of art.
Yeah, but I'm when I say expressionistic, I don't mean that you don't have the fundamentals of anatomy down. If you're truly going to be and excel at...
I wasn't implying the 90s was the expressionist era of
comic
books.
Well, actually, I've heard a lot of people kind of claim or apologize for some of the 90s style choices as being more expressionistic. And I, like, as an artist myself, don't buy it by that at all. It's just bullshit. Because if you look at having, like, an understanding of the structure underneath in order to break it, like, you have to have A before you can go to B. You do. You can't just cheat and kind of fudge it a little bit and then call it expressionistic.
Sure.
So, Shelley and Sargent, that's my dream team. No big deal. I'll see if they're available.
Okay. That's fine. Yeah, it's an interesting debate because then you're debating comics in terms of purely artistic motifs.
A little bit. But I don't do that very often, so let me do it today.
That's fine, but I mean, I personally, I don't like to do that often. I like to look at that.
Just today.
That's fine. I'm just saying, in general, it's fun to, for me to look at comics in terms of eras, as opposed to, like, you know, and I guess that kind of applies to art, too, but instead of styles, I think eras kind of apply a little better.
But you just have a different, I don't know, a different encyclopedia of comics knowledge than I do.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. You gave me a big box of your comics. It's not that much different than, like, that stuff from the 90s is a lot of the same stuff I was reading.
No. I just mean that the way that you categorize it in your head is totally different from the way that I do. You categorize things as a collector would. You have an understanding of context in a different way than I do.
Oh, okay, that's fair. Yeah.
So it's not that we weren't exposed to the same things because we're roughly the same age, but your organization of it in your head
the correct way.
I paused to allow you to make whatever snarky comment you intended to make,
and I was going to let it go, you know, so you're baiting me
a little
and
bit
then, yeah, okay,
yep,
that's fine.
But I think that actually speaks very loudly to kind of our different personalities and actually our strengths. Like, you're not as familiar with, I don't know, call it art history or aesthetics or historical and cultural criticism in various art forms, right?
I guess so.
Oh, come on. You're not.
You, Why not? How do you figure?
Because I've
I went to a liberal arts school. I've got a liberal arts degree.
You have a liberal arts degree. I've got a fucking pile of master's degrees in that particular area of study. That's all I'm saying. I spent a little bit more time with it. That's all. It doesn't mean that you can't appreciate it. You are a computer guy with the things and the stuff. So you organize stuff differently in your head than I do. That's all.
Look, just because I didn't go to a fancy school to learn about art,
it's
and I had to learn
about
it on the streets.
That was kind of a bullshit snobby thing for me to say. I actually don't mean it that way. I just mean that in general, your approach is more analytical than mine. And it always has been.
It's fine. I just want people to understand that I got my PhD from the University of Hard Knocks.
You're adorable. Can we talk about comics?
Well, I guess that's what we're here to do,
or,
right?
I don't know. Anything else you want to talk about?
Not really. I mean, what else is there to talk about besides comic books?
Well, specifically this week, we're talking about how neither of us get a whole bunch of sleep.
Yeah. You know, I mean, in theory, I get 7 hours a night.
How much do you actually get?
Well, I don't think I'm like you. I know you, like, you can't fall asleep. Like, I fall asleep immediately. And, you know, as soon as I can go to sleep, I'm asleep. But it's not necessarily good sleep.
When was the last time you had a really good night's sleep?
Luke just turned 4.
Mm-hmm.
So, 4 years?
Okay.
Probably.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, probably.
That sucks.
Well, that's why I'm so disgusting.
I get it. I slept very well at Emerald City, so I had like a month or so ago of really good sleep. And then before that, I don't know. I wake up a lot. I have a lot of bad dreams. I do much better when I'm not sleeping by myself because I can relax, I think. So if I wake up and freak out, I don't know, something about being by myself in that situation makes it more, like, I'm more aware of it. I'm just enough more conscious of it. So
weird. See, like, if I was in a place where I was just by myself, I probably would sleep very soundly.
Yeah. Nope. Not me.
That's why we're opposites.
God, thank goodness.
Yeah, like, the sleep, like, being asleep but conscious of other people around me, really kind of pulls me out of sleep often.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I find it very comforting to have, like, a sort of rock kind of holding me there. It's just for whatever reason, on, like, a non-conscious level, because I'm not ever totally awake in that situation, but it is comforting and it is grounding, like, quite literally.
No, I understand that, and I think that's true for a lot of people. I had a roommate, my college roommate, she would have night terrors from time to time, and she wouldn't wake up until somebody kind of woke her up.
Yeah.
You know, she would be screaming and running around the house.
I don't do that, to my knowledge.
But, I mean, she had an actual sleep disorder.
That's
and, like, it wouldn't
crazy.
Stop until somebody kind of, like, pulled her out of it.
That super sucks for her and
so, like,
else.
Yeah, she wouldn't want to be alone because if that happened, like, it happened one time, like, where her boyfriend and I weren't, you know, we weren't at the apartment, and she had one, and she was screaming for, like, you know, 20 minutes
that
until somebody came
shit.
And knocked on the door.
I have a lot of nightmares. I mean, a couple of times a night sometimes. So I can relate to that interruption of sleep, but not, I always wake myself up. And then it sucks and I don't necessarily want to go back to sleep, but I don't think that I've ever been unable to get myself out of it for that length of time. It feels like it when you're in a dream. Holy shit, it feels like it's never ending and you have no control over it. But in reality, for me, in reality, it's not. You want to talk about our comics in relationship to all of this?
Sure, I guess so.
We might as well introduce the first one.
Okay.
Dear Comic Therapist, my name is Adi, your podcast listener from Indonesia. Before I start, I need to ask to Aaron, is your comic book store called Emerald City Store near University of Oregon? When I went to U of O for college, that comic book store is the one that made me fall in love with the Western comic book, which was an upgrade after I started out as an anime fan. if this is the same comic book store that you managed, I personally say, in my most sincere voice, thank you. Now, for my second nerd confession, which is actually on theme, match made in heaven for the comic artist duo. My two favorite duos for the last decade have been Grant Morrison and Frank Quietly, and Rick Remender and Jerome Opina. Now, my dream team picks would depend on the genre or publisher's intent. I would pick Jason Aaron and Sean Phillips for crime fiction genre, and Scott Snyder and Jerome Opina for horror genre. I also have this must-buy on whatever they are paired, Brian K. Kavanaugh and Mike Allred for their brilliant, witty, and wacky approach, then Warren Ellis and James Stoke for epic approach, and lastly for the two big publishers, bring back Joss Whedon and pair him with Steve McNiven to make us nerds wet ourselves and take our money. Wow, this is a long one. I guess that's what happens if a nerd who's been keeping it a secret for 14 years finally confesses. Woo! Wow, I guess the therapy has been worthwhile. Thanks. P.S. You guys have great chemistry, and Aaron is always right, Andrea. Kidding. Maybe?
Our first book this week is Dream Police number 1, written by J. Michael Straczynski, with art by Sid Kotian, and colors by Bill Farmer. Lettering is by Troy Pateri. Dream Police is published by Image Comics.
So I'm actually going to just read the introductory narrative from the first page of the book, because it sets the stage and the tone very nicely for the story and what will probably be our discussion. Who knows? This is the dreamscape. 100 million dreamers come here every hour. Some come to relive their pasts, others to imagine their future. But everyone comes expecting to have a good time according to the rules set down when the dreamscape was created. When that doesn't happen, when something goes wrong, I go to work. I carry a badge. My name's Joe Thursday, Lieutenant Detective, Dream Police. My partner's Frank Stafford. So that's our introduction to this conceit that...
It's very... why can't I think of the movie now? Or the TV show?
Dragnet?
Yes, Dragnet.
Okay, there you go.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's like Dragnet meets Inception.
Yeah, that's kind of true.
Yep. I didn't write that down, but I was going to throw that out there as my analysis.
Oh, well, there you go.
No, I think it's an interesting conceit where we have a little bit more structure to a dream world than, like, the actual dreams or dream worlds that we all experience. And the idea that the unconscious state is shared.
Mm-hmm.
And yet in some way policed, and I mean like lowercase p policed. So it's somewhat organized, or there is a higher power, but not necessarily spiritually involved here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and organizationally.
Organizationally. I think that's fucking awesome. I actually really enjoyed the premise, maybe not as much as the follow through in this particular case, but I think that this idea of an organizational structure to where we go when we're not present in this life is kind of cool.
Like, what would Jung say about this comic?
Oh, man. Freud and Jung together and their ridiculousness about dreams is like a whole separate podcast. It's a whole separate fucking college, not even course. It's a whole separate, like, wing of psychology, man.
Sure, but, I mean... This is definitely drawing on some of those elements.
Yes, and replacing them with, like, a pop culture motif.
Sure, but isn't everything...
Isn't that what comics does?
Kind of, or isn't kind of any kind of, I don't know, you know, medium, like, that comments on things that we deal with. It's basically that.
Right, right. Yeah. I think that the point that he makes at the very beginning, the point that Joe makes at the very beginning, that the expectation is positive, that the separation between dreams as like opportunity to relive an experience versus, I don't know, it just seems much more lucid, or the intention is much more lucid. But then, like, obviously we come across an actual lucid dreamer and it's just fucking bananas.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. But I think that the, and maybe this is because I rarely have memorable positive dream experiences, I think that it's kind of a lovely premise that we're all gonna get together and agree that we're gonna come expecting to have a good time in the dreamscape. Okay, everyone, that sounds awesome.
Do you think, like, especially for you, not having good dreams is kind of that, it's sort of like, does a healthy mind have good dreams and
what are you saying there, Aaron?
Disturbed mind always has, you know, nightmares or just, you know, distressful dreams.
I don't know, because I don't necessarily have realistic bad dreams. For example, the dream that woke me up this morning, I've been thinking about this all day because it was really bothering me. I've been having an extra hard time sleeping this week and didn't really sleep much at all. Last night, or two nights ago, I guess. And so I was very, very tired last night, but couldn't settle down. When I finally fell asleep, this is the dream that woke me up around, like a little bit before 5 this morning. I was killing a witch. And I mean that in the very visceral sense, like almost like a rag doll, like just beating her body against the ground, and I could hear the bones breaking. That's kind of fucked up. I don't necessarily want to spend a lot of time analyzing how that relates to the healthy or not healthy state of my brain, but it certainly has nothing to do with my actual life whatsoever.
No, of course not. But I don't think most people, it's not a dream it's the difference between dreaming and just thinking about what's going on in your life.
Absolutely. But you can't argue the fact that a lot of the elements that in most common dreams come from our day-to-day experiences. I mean, your brain kind of catalogs all of these bits and pieces of bullshit that you're exposed to and then, like, blah, 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 puts it all out for you when you're sleeping. I don't know where that came from. I have zero experience with any of that. And there was, like, a whole lead-up story. I mean, it was fairly involved, but it wasn't me. Right? Like,
no,
it's not.
No, of course not. That's, I don't think dreams are for most people.
But
it's really your brain just relaxing and then just kind of like, it just runs a routine of having to parse through all the things going on in your life. And I think, you know, in terms of like computer type stuff, it's the walls between all the file folders comes down and it just kind of siphons out.
Do you
and so
find
it
that you
manifests
dream,
in a lot of ways?
Do you dream more frequently when you're stressed in your actual life?
And probably not. I can't say one way or the other. I would say I probably would dream more if I wasn't stressed because I wouldn't be waking up as frequently, so I'd be in REM longer.
Okay.
You know, but that's just the practicality of like my sleep cycle. So it's like if I have a lot of stuff to do and I know I'm going to have to do it, I tend to wake up at these kind of pretty regular intervals during the night. Mm-hmm. That are, you know, so if I sleep 7 hours, say I fall asleep at 9, I'll pretty much always wake up at midnight, and then I'll wake up like between 2:30 and 3 again, and then sleep again till 4:30 or 4:15, and then get out of bed.
But do you remember what you've been dreaming about at those intervals?
Sometimes, and sometimes not. And it's usually the kind of thing that if I do, it kind of just, you know, the memory dissipates quickly.
I actually think one of the most interesting facets to the dreamscape world in Dream Police was the couple of comments that we get about what the dreamscape experience then translates to, like, the waking consciousness. That happens with the guy with the cat. That happens with, like, when the actual nightmares come, in terms of how kind of frequently they intend to be part of that lucid dreamer's dream experiences from then on out. It implies, and obviously this is fictional, but it implies this, I don't know, like a acknowledgement that probably greater than 95% of our dreams disappear. Like, we don't actually retain the memories very often.
Yeah, I don't think it. I think that's probably by design in a real sense, on the in the comic sense here.
Mm-hmm.
But that it's not important for you to remember the details of the dream, because all the dream was to your brain was just a way to, you know, file all these things going on in your life.
Mm-hmm. So sometimes I wake up and I'm super freaked out, but then I don't remember why. And then I can usually calm myself down enough to go back to sleep. And other times I actually have like enough of the story that I can, like, I can remember and visualize. And that, for some reason, that's more, man, I was going to say that that's more disruptive, but in a way, sometimes it actually allows me to like process it and move on.
Because then it's not a mystery what was freaking you out?
Yeah, a little bit. This morning was an exception just because it was like the very last thing that happened before I woke up. It wasn't a middle of the night dream, but it...
Yeah, that's usually the stuff, I think, for anyone. It's the last thing you're dreaming about that you're going to remember. You're not going to remember whatever was happening, you know, early in your sleep cycle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I do have a lot of like normal, benign dreams about like people I talk to and things that I have to do and like shit I have to take care of. And
your fingers or penises and...
No.
I mean, what?
I've never had that dream. Do you have that dream frequently? Is there something that you want to talk about, Aaron?
And your teeth are is actually hair and...
Teeth falling out dream, or the loose teeth dream that is a pretty common like dream motif, apparently.
I'm on sick people.
No, I don't remember what it means. But there's a science to studying dreams, and then there's like a fucking dream symbology thing that supposedly different reoccurring images in our dreams mean stuff. I'm actually hoping that Dream Police gets into that, because I think that the transfer of some of those symbols into like characters or something in our dreams would be really interesting.
Sort of like dream avatars in a way?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, I'm trying to think of one that I'm actually familiar with, but like, despite being a fairly dreamy kind of person, dream-y, not dreamy as a description of myself, but I don't have a lot of like actual knowledge of these dream symbols. But
oh, that's not one of your many degrees.
Fuck you. It's just a difference in the way that we organize the world, Aaron Myers.
It's true. Some of us only have one degree.
I like school. What can I say?
I guess you could say lots of things, probably in many languages.
No, I suck at languages really, really badly.
We found your Achilles heel.
I've got like 20 Achilles heels. Give me a break.
Well, all right, hippie. You ready to move on to our second one?
Yeah. I just want to emphasize this Inception meets Dragnet thing, because I actually thought that was a pretty good take on this book.
Yes, we all got that. You got that.
Yeah. Okay.
Congratulations.
Right, that's all.
Great
point.
That's
all I wanted to say.
You can dream about it tonight, about your victory.
Shut up. Moving on.
And then in the dream, somebody will take away the metal and stomp on it.
Right.
Yeah, and break your bones, and then you'll be the witch, and you'll have to figure it out.
I could hear the crunching. It was so fucked up.
Hey, so yeah, my creator dream team would be centered around a project, as the right creators working on the right title would be key. Well, Matt Fraction leads up a brilliant Hawkeye book today. My dream team would cover a more traditional Hawkeye writer, Mark Grunwald. The late Mark Grunwald defined Hawkeye as a character for me in the 80s, and so he'd be a perfect fit for this title that would feature a costume-wearing heroic Hawkeye. Artist, Chris Samnee, with colors by Klaus Janson. Samnee brings an excellent kind of cartoony style to the current Daredevil book. His style with Jensen's edgier coloring would make a nice blend of cartoon and rawness. And the book would be lettered by Joe Caramanga, who does awesome work on the current Daredevil title.
Our second book is Bad Dreams, number one. The first comic in an all-new, all-ages miniseries published by Red 5 Comics. It's written and drawn by Gary Winnick.
Okay, so this is all-ages, but the description actually hit very close to home. Quote, when Mother Night goes missing, everyone slowly loses their minds from a lack of sleep, because I think we've all been there, possibly right now. Anyway, here's the rest of the solicit. From the co-creator of Lucasfilm's Maniac Mansion comes a lavishly illustrated twisted tale of whimsy bouncing off classic fairy tale tradition. I think this is a really interesting exploration of dreams and sleep from an all-ages perspective.
Yeah, it has a lot of, like, at least this first issue felt to me like it had aspects of Wizard of Oz, obviously.
Yeah, right.
And maybe Labyrinth, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Just, like, kid protagonist going on a journey in a dreamland is a fairly common scenario. I was thinking about the fact that, like, Wizard of Oz, to me, is this... It's like the penultimate dream sequence. And it doesn't usually get classified that way. Not that I'm, like, a major Wizard of Oz scholar. I don't have that degree.
No, not yet.
Cross that one off the list. But, I mean, that's essentially what happens to Dorothy, is that she's dreaming the whole time.
But yeah.
She has this collection of people, and she goes about on her merry way to this end destination, and there's this kind of forces of evil working against her for whatever reason.
Sure. It's also bridges that gap, too, between was it all a dream or was there an aspect of reality to it?
Sure. Sure. And I think... I
don't know if we've got that here, because it's only our first issue.
But... Yeah, we don't know yet with this one. But I guess that's more in the vein of, like, Narnia, where it's this kind of fantasy realm, but how does it relate back to the real world? And I actually, when I was thinking about this, Harold and the Purple Crayon?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have that for your kids?
Uh-huh.
So that... I don't have a strong memory of that from when I was a kid. But I started using that book when I was teaching art, and I used it in my, like, lower grades as a jumping off point for a project. Then when I actually got it for Avi, it's a really kind of fucked up story. It's a very strange situation that this little Harold kid is in, as he has this crayon that he's drawing his world. And then I realized that, like, it's pretty much likely that it's all happening while he's asleep, and then I was able to accept it. But in a lot of ways, this protagonist, Mary, has, like Harold, she's not really afraid. Like, she's got exposure to these, like, monsters right off the bat when she falls asleep, but she's like game for anything. Whatever, we'll just go on this quest and it's fine. And I think that that's something kind of inherent about the all ages category, that you want to present, like, a strong character who's in this unusual circumstance but who's not totally freaking out about it.
I also think, like, extending that, like, another good story that deals with some of this stuff, I'm sure you've seen it, Never Ending Story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, has a lot of, like, that the child building reality,
right? Yeah,
you know, and the story is happening while you're reading it, or, you know, in this case, maybe sleeping it or whatever. You know, and the whole, I like the aspects of, like, time, too, like, when it comes to reading and children and that sort of thing. I think children in reality, whether they're awake or asleep, time works very differently.
Yeah, actually. There's something about setting this, or setting any of those, in, like, a fantasy world, meaning that the time experience of both the character and the reader can be played around with quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting point. I hadn't thought about that.
Well, also, like... So much of these two, I think what's kind of lost, or what feels very disingenuous sometimes with stories like this, if it's an adult,
mm-hmm.
is the acceptance of all these kind of fantastical elements.
Yeah, and I think that's what I mean about, like, the child protagonist is not afraid to be in this dream world, fantasy world, whatever, whereas an adult would be freaking out and or analyzing how to get home, or, mm-hmm. like, not up for the quest or what have you.
Right. When a kid, it's like, yeah, of course there's a rat king. Why wouldn't there be?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because, you know, especially, like, at four, like, Luke, like, he doesn't know that a rat king doesn't exist. So if you tell him a rat king exists, sure, a rat king exists, because I don't know. He doesn't know anything about the world, you know?
Does Luke have bad dreams?
Not that often. Not really.
I don't really remember Avi having what I would consider a bad dream enough that I was aware of it, so that he woke up and like called for me or something. And I was trying to remember when I first became aware of having trouble sleeping or like having bad dreams as a kid or whatever. I think that you have to teach a kid that sleep can be scary.
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't think so. I think some kids, it's just a matter of how your brain works. Like, I think for some kids that just happens and others it doesn't. Yeah, he doesn't. He's at the point where he's made up a manifestation, I think, for anxiety and for things that scare him.
And what is
like,
that?
It's a, like a, you know, he calls him Walking Yoda.
Huh.
And so, you know, Walking Yoda hides behind, like, the, one of the bookshelves. And, you know, Walking Yoda is going to get him.
Is it or, a, like, an imaginary non-friend? Like an,
right, exactly, yeah.
Huh.
And so, you know, we talk about, well, what's, you know, what is, why is Walking Yoda upset and that sort of thing. So it's that sort of externalization of, you know, maybe bad feelings or something.
But has he ever talked about more of a dream-like interaction with Walking Yoda?
I don't think so. I mean, maybe, but we might not also be at that cognitive point to separate it. So, you know, we might, that might be this year.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see, like, when you're more aware of thinking awake and thinking asleep. And I think for kids, that takes a while to separate.
Right. I was just trying to think if there was a point at which reading bad dreams, number one, would be more scary for slightly older kids than slightly younger kids.
Yeah, well, it's wherever that age switch is where kids understand the real and the fantastical, right. But your brain is still so active that the fantastical is terrifying.
So like 35?
Sure.
I mean, I'm going to be 35 in like 6 weeks. So I'll tell you, after June 17th, we can decide whether I'm able to separate fantasy from reality.
Well, maybe it doesn't change for people throughout their whole lives. But there's definitely a point where it's like, you knew, like, watching E.T. the movie or something like that, like, this wasn't real, but you can't shake it regardless, you know, if something in there disturbed you.
Yes, absolutely. Do you think that you could sit down with Bad Dreams and read it with Luke and he would be cool with it?
Yeah, I don't think it would. Yeah, I don't think it would matter at four to him.
Okay.
Like, it would just be characters and pictures and, you know, that sort of thing. Like, it's that complexity isn't there yet.
Because I actually think, and I haven't given it to Avi to read yet, but I think on the other side of that, I think at almost nine, he wouldn't be bothered by it either. Like, maybe there's a sweet spot in the middle where it would actually be a little frightening. But I think at this point, he would be more intrigued about breaking down the story elements, or at least that's kind of the phase that he's in right now, where it's almost like
or the adventure portion.
Yeah, the adventure part and like the fantasy setting, the dreamlike setting is secondary to like the problem solving. Which is, I don't know, kind of a cool thing that kids do around that age.
But if it's meant to be like an all ages book that a kid, you know, like Avi's age could have accessible, you don't want it to be terrifying. So not terrifying for kids, like something like the Stuff of Legend, it would be, because Stuff of Legend isn't really for kids and it's so intense that it's an adult book that deals with very, you know, with a lot of child themes, but that's not the intended audience, I don't think.
Right. It's a little touch and go anytime you have like a child character put in a non-childlike setting. Right? Like, the entire cast, important cast of Lock and Key is under the age of 18, but that's not a kid's book at all.
Right, yeah.
So I think that it's important, though, like what you were saying, if it's too scary, it's off-putting. If it's not engaging enough in being, like, sort of fleshed out as a dreamlike world or a fantasy world, it's also kind of off-putting for a kid who kind of needs that like depth of environment to be more engaged in the story. So I'm sort of excited to see where this goes, as something to share with Avi specifically, because we don't have a lot of all ages books that we're both enjoying right now. So, like I said, I haven't given this one to him yet, but it's quite different from the rest of the ones that we're reading, and I think it will be a good conversation point about some of the things that, like, you and I just talked about, but with him.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Yay.
Well, do you want to talk to a man who is all ages accessible?
I hope that's not a transition to our interview, since I'm not entirely sure that I would classify Joe Harris that way.
Me either, but that was the best I could come up with.
Right. He, as an individual, I'm sure is very all ages friendly, but certainly the books that we talked about that he's writing right now, not so much.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. But I applaud you for once again coming up with a completely useless transition.
Thank you. My streak continues.
Yep.
All right, well, let's talk to him.
Okay.
Hey, guys, long-time listener, first-time writer, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, my dream creative team would be Neil Gaiman and Mike Allred on an ongoing Doctor Who comic. Look, I don't care which Doctor or companion, although I think they killed it with the 11th Doctor and the Pawns or Clara. Gaiman can write anything, though, and clearly has a lot of love for the Doctor. Allred would nail the likeness while maintaining his signature style, plus he could let loose and draw some pretty amazing cosmic shit. Second choice would be Jeff Johns and Patrick Zercher on Guardians of the Galaxy with covers by Brian Boland. I mean, Johns can write space adventures and teen books like nobody else, and Zercher can draw the hell out of anything. Thanks, and keep up the good work. This is Cam! No, the other one. Cam!
This week on The Couch, we're speaking with writer Joe Harris. Joe's written for all of the major publishing companies, including Marvel, DC, Dark Horse, and Dynamite. He published two creator-owned miniseries, Ghost Project and Spontaneous, and a graphic novel, Wars in Toyland, with Oni Press. He's, of course, currently writing his creator-owned series, Great Pacific, published by Image Comics, which we talked about 2 weeks ago in episode 37, and X-Files Season 10, published by IDW, which we talked about way back in September in episode 9. Thanks for hanging out with us, Joe.
Oh, you're very welcome. I am very happy to be here.
Even post C2E2, you still have some energy left?
Remarkably, yes, because we got out of town last night, so we've been, my girlfriend and I flew back to New York last night, and we beat all the hellish weather that I've heard so many other people have been kind of snagged trying to get out of there today, because of.
Yeah, I'm good.
Wow.
Fortuitous timing.
Yeah, yeah.
Plus an extra couple of hours to just, get yourself acclimated to real life. I know I had a heck of a time readjusting after Seattle. Did you leave Seattle Sunday night, or did you leave on Monday?
I left Seattle Sunday night and flew down to LA. So I was kind of in a dreamscape travel thing for a few weeks after that. So
awesome.
Yeah, most of your life at this point has been spent in comic conventions and airports, I guess.
Yeah, maybe a few too many, but yes, at this point, every time I look up, I feel like I'm getting ready to take off on a tarmac, and it's getting a little bit of a grind, but all for good causes.
Yeah,
well, mostly.
That's the glamorous life of a comic book creator.
Right.
Super glamorous.
Well, let's talk about comic books then.
Right on.
So Great Pacific is solidly in its second year, and X-Files Season 10 has been moving along since fall. Are there any other projects on the horizon for 2014 or kind of beyond that you want to give us a heads up about, people should be aware of?
There are absolutely projects coming this back half, 2014 and beyond. I can give you a limited heads up on them. I can't, unfortunately, reveal. I don't think I can reveal all that much about.
Nobody's bitten on this yet, but one of these days, somebody's going to spill a whole lot of spoilers. But you know, that's what we keep asking. But yeah, anything you want people to be aware of?
Sure, I've got at least two new creator-owned series that you're going to be hearing more about the back half of this year, going into 2015. Something new. With Image Comics, I've got a new book at Oni Press I've also got a new series that we'll be announcing from Dynamite at some point in the not too distant future.
Cool.
What else? What else? I know that there is more.
Say Dynamite has been, they've been really putting out a lot and tapping a lot of great talent lately.
They are prolific. They are prolific. Oh, and also, by the way, new, we're going to be doing some additional X-Files stuff later, but, cool. nothing I can really go further into, but that, that line and my involvement with it is going very strong and is going to get stronger.
Oh, great.
Wow. That's excellent. So the Oni book we talked to, who was that who mentioned the timeline? I think it was Dennis Culver.
Yes.
Was talking about the production timeline with the Oni graphic novels. Are you talking about a new graphic novel or a new ongoing with them?
It's going to be a new series of graphic novels that will be serialized in a yet to be disclosed format.
Okay.
But you'll hear more soon. It's going to be something really cool. It's something I first brought to the company a long time ago, and we've been waiting really for the right time to come along to do it. And it's something I'm really passionate about, and I am incredibly excited to finally say something more than I can say at present about it. So
sure.
Hopefully soon.
We'll look forward to that. So in addition to your comics work, you're also a screenwriter. Can you talk about your approach to each medium and kind of how it differs?
Well, I guess they're similar and different in a few ways. It really depends on the kind of screenwriting you're talking about, in the sense that if it's something that I'm creating from the outset, if I'm either going to make a new short film, which is stuff I've done plenty of times, or if I'm going to write a new spec script that seeks to sell something original, it's not all that different than coming up with and executing on a creator-owned comic idea. I mean, you have your concept, you think about the point of view and the parameters you want to tell it in,
mm-hmm.
and you execute. With regard to the other type of screenwriting, quote unquote, that a working writer who's chasing assignments and opportunities might find him or herself involved with, which admittedly I'm not doing all that much of these days because I'm really focused on getting out original content and, mm-hmm. and developing more and more of my ideas, for which I have found comics are actually a much more fun and satisfying, creatively speaking, medium to do that in. You're really talking about serving different masters and serving the needs of what the assignment is. Being a screenwriter, again, and I put air quotes around that because there's so much more that goes into that than actually just sitting down and writing.
Sure.
There's meetings and there's pitches and there's coming up with, what's just familiarly referred to as a take on the material that you might be circling or someone might want you to come up with. That's a bit of a process, and you're trying to fit needs. In my experience, it's not always fun. I mean, sometimes you're just chasing an opportunity. You're chasing what could be, even if it's on the small end of that that workspace, a pretty decent sized payday.
Mm-hmm.
But you're making the distinction, or it sounds like you're making the distinction between a more creative collaboration as opposed to oftentimes the nuts and bolts of the business side, the collaborative part that is the result of more of a work for hire experience, right? But that's the distinction you're making then with screenwriting?
Sort of. I mean, just, I can just give you, an example. A lot of my experience being of having been a guy who had some, made movie credits and was being sent out on different meetings, chasing different opportunities. A lot of that effort was just a matter of getting a studio or a producer to say yes or come close to saying yes, so mm-hmm. that the next step in some process might be affected.
Right. Okay.
And it might not even lead to that particular project getting written. It might lead to you doing something else.
It's like the Rube Goldberg process of screenwriting, as opposed
to, I guess so.
Right, sitting down with a pitch that you have more control over in comics.
Yeah. Now, just creatively speaking, all things being equal, I don't find them all that dissimilar. I mean, again, conceptualizing something and then figuring out how you're going to execute it. I don't think it's all that different. I mean, mm-hmm. if anything, I'm directing more when I'm writing comics. I mean, I feel like when my comic book scripts are pretty much how I've edited the movie in my head. And then that's not to say that there isn't ample room for interpretation and collaboration on how that's going to eventually be put together on the finished page. Mm-hmm. But it's not that level of direction doesn't necessarily make it into a piece of screenwriting that I might work on. But there are some similarities too, just in terms of how you work as a writer throughout the process of putting these things together. I mean, while I was just talking about 30 seconds ago, another similarity popped into my head in which I was hired once to do some uncredited work on a horror movie that involved sort of reimagining this big climactic ending. And they had already shot 90% of the movie, but they needed to to basically reimagine a few key things to address some notes and concerns that the different parties who come up with such notes and concerns in this process have. But there were very hard, like I said, 90% of the movie had already been shot and the budget mm-hmm. was very small. So you've got to think on your feet in terms of, okay, we've got, say one more day of shooting that we can possibly do. These actors are available. These actors are not. Just the schedule will only allow for the camera to be set up one place. So, so you can't, everything you have a checklist, a mental checklist or, a physical one of what needs to be accomplished. But you have these very hard and fast realities that you also have to steer around, and you have to find some way creatively to get it done with very limited means. Mm-hmm. And we found a way to do it, I think. in that regard, I can think just process-wise, the similarity to comics are I get pages back, be it on a creator-owned series or work for hire. And some things change, either small, which always happens, or, sometimes dramatically, and you need to really do some serious editing to what the text is going to be, the dialogue, the narration, the ballooning, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that happens all the time too. And that's just in a parallel sense, I can equate the two processes with those examples.
Is it also like, it seems like it would be hard to break out of the mode, or maybe you wouldn't even want to these days, of writing your stories with also the intention of what would this be like if it was on the screen too? Like when you're writing Great Pacific, obviously you have the story in mind and you're scripting the comic, but at the same time, is that kind of a consideration? Like, I think it's probably realistic that everything written these days would also be nice to translate to a small screen or a big screen.
Well, I'm sure everyone has at least one eye on that. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I would be very disingenuous if I told you I did not. Now, I can also tell you that I got back into comics almost expressly with the intent to actually start putting down a body of work behind me that I would be proud to leave behind, because I had an earlier career in comics before there was a pause when I segued into making horror movies and chasing other Hollywood opportunities. Mm-hmm. And I don't really look back as fondly on the work I did back then, even though I know that it had its fans and it has its place, however small or big in history, particularly related to that time. First and foremost, I really want to make good comics. And I know that's the diplomatic answer, but it is true. And I would qualify that by saying I've always had, luckily, I guess, this knack for creating things that get the attention of people in a position of making a decision in those other mediums like TV and movies. I mean, sometimes, it seems like some of the most amazing successes I've had on that front weren't necessarily because I was overly ambitious and pursuing those opportunities, but because I something just innate in what I was doing led me to them. And this has happened on a few occasions. And believe me, there have been times where I wish I could I could figure it out and break it down into a formula that I could follow and even increase you know, the rate of success while decreasing the some of the stress and or anxiety that goes along with all of this.
Sure.
But
right.
I've always been, you know, fortunate enough, I guess, that what the things I conceive tend to lend themselves, I guess, to that other stuff, mm-hmm. like other mediums. But again, you know, to be diplomatic, and I really do mean this, when I make these comics, particularly when I'm putting out these creator-owned series, which again, admittedly, I do hope will turn into something else as well. It's very important for me to leave behind a backlog at this point in my life and my career that I can be proud of, and represents me in a way that. I guess that's self-explanatory. Just something that I feel is very representative of who I am and what I want to say.
Yeah, your proper legacy in a way.
I guess. I mean, that sounds so highfalutin to say.
But that's what that word means, and right. I don't think there's anything wrong with acknowledging that you're talking about the longevity of your body of work, and that's something to take pride in.
Yeah, I would think so. I'm just, you know, I mean, you know, life has taught me humility, and I don't take for granted necessarily that what it is I have to say is going to be some raging success, or I guess I can say my life's experiences creatively, business-wise, just. You know, what goes with the territory of being a creator in creative fields that are incredibly competitive and filled with, you know, all sorts of pitfalls, both creative and business. You learn that you grow up a bit and you get wise. And I'm at a point in my life where I'm just very grateful for any success I find. And
that's
just how I try to look at this.
Well, we're gonna come back to your creator-owned work in a second, but I actually do want to go a little deeper with the work for hire stuff from your past, just because when I was preparing for this interview, a friend mentioned to me specifically how much he missed Slingers, and we talked about the role of being a work for hire writer, developing new characters and new stories within a larger universe that you relinquish control. And how often characters get sort of forgotten within the larger machine. And it doesn't sound like you're bothered too much by this, which is good and very healthy. but, you know, like a character like Dusk, who hasn't really been seen much again. So is it a weird thing knowing, though, that you enter into that relationship in work for hire, knowing that you don't have control, but yet there is that creation of yours that's out there and could like maybe appear again one day.
I mean, potentially I could see where you're coming from. I could imagine a situation in which that would feel kind of strange. You know, with regard to, you know, just specifically with regard to Slingers, which was the first monthly book I ever wrote. I was really, really young and green, working at a very, shall we say, more dysfunctional Marvel Comics back then,
sure.
You know, without much guidance, without much experience, sort of just left to follow through on the opportunities that were dangled in front of me. I don't really have a deep connection to those characters as my creations, as something that. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. I was not working in the comics industry very much at all back when I forgot who was even involved, but I know they killed a couple of the characters, didn't they? I think Hornet's dead,
but that doesn't matter.
Yeah, right. you know, but it matters to the fans, because some of them, every once in a while, one of them does reach out to me, or they've been coming up to the shows a lot. Like this one guy came up to me in Seattle with, he literally fanned out the entire series in front of me and said, I was four when I was buying all of these. Oh, God.
Wow.
But if they ask, you know, what happened, why are they dead? You can say there's always time travel. People can always come back.
Right. Yeah, no one's really ever dead.
Yep.
At least in Marvel.
I was tickled when I think Brian K. Vaughan brought Ricochet into that Runaways spinoff team at one point, didn't he? And that was kind of cool to see.
Mm-hmm.
So I could certainly imagine a situation in which that would feel really, really weird. I know plenty of creators that have created something that's ended up in, you know, one of the X-Men films or, you know, one of the other big franchises that have gone from being a DC or Marvel property to something that's now a Hollywood franchise. And they, you know, generally they're excited by it. You know, they don't always agree when it happens, and they certainly hope they got compensated, whatever fair compensation means when
right.
you create a character that ends up there. But, I don't know.
It does
I don't
sound
really...
like you have a very, I don't know, I guess a clear detachment with your, and some of this I'm sure also comes with maturity as a writer. You've made the distinction already that you were very young when you were writing for Marvel, as opposed to the, and that series specifically, as opposed to the writing that you're doing now. I mean, even with X-Files, there's a different way that you have spoken about it compared to that work for hire situation when you were much younger. So I guess we were just curious, as more from an outside perspective, if there is a difference in the way that you kind of approach your engagement with the characters when they aren't yours, as opposed to when you're writing Great Pacific, where you have complete investment personally in that story and in that character because you own it. It's a sort of mental, emotional exercise that.
Estimating. Well, I mean, in talking about something I create, I mean, the characters in Great Pacific are very dear to me, and they are representative of some core belief or desire for me to get these concepts and these sorts of characters out on the page for mm-hmm. particular reasons that are both I'm chomping at the bit to do, and then others which present themselves in the actual execution of the material. When it comes to writing other characters created by somebody else, I don't think I put any less care into it, particularly, you mentioned the X-Files and just working with, you know, writing Mulder and Scully. I mean, that's both when I first got the job, I have to admit, I was kind of terrified because I know that these are passionate fans, and I know that they haven't had a fix in a long time.
Right.
And I, you know, I'd be a liar if I said I wasn't nervous that it was going to be, well, there was a part of me that was just worried they were just going to be incredibly picky and unaccepting of this vision. But, you know, now I feel like I've got a lot of confidence at this point going forward, and I feel like I know what I want to do, and I'm confident I have the voices of these characters down. And most importantly, to get to your point, I'm a fan too, and I do put a lot of effort into. Yeah, I mean, I really am a fan of that series and those characters. And when I close my eyes, I don't even have to try very hard to hear them talking, and it's actually really easy for me to write. On the one hand, as opposed to something like Great Pacific or some of my other creator-owned endeavors that I'm currently working on, because there's so much to draw from that exists.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with Great Pacific, I'm constantly making up not only what it is you eventually read, but the backstory that informs it. And
sure.
Not to say that that's necessarily harder, because it's all fun, and it's all, you know, and on my best days, it all happens pretty effortlessly. Unfortunately, my best days don't happen all the time. But
that makes sense that you would have that emotional connection as a fan that would feed into your writing. That totally makes sense. I get it.
Do you think some of the nervousness, though, is assuaged by, because you get to collaborate with Chris Carter, right, on X-Files? Like you can kind of, or you got to sound off some ideas and,
mm-hmm.
and kind of work on that. So you sort of had that font of creation to kind of tap into, at least initially, you know, to make sure you're going in the right direction and that you're being true to the TV series.
Well, knowing that he's a fan of what I do, knowing that he has spoken both, you know, with me present as well as independently to how much he enjoys what it is we do and that, you know, he's confident I'm the right guy to be doing it. That has that alone has been incredibly validating to both, again, as a fan, as well as, a you know, a nervous creator who isn't sure whether or not fandom is going to accept what he he's doing or not.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's like the ultimate validation right there. You're done. You can just go back.
It was nice.
Writing.
It's not bad.
That's well, that gives you carte blanche to do now whatever you want.
Oh, right.
I wouldn't go that far because I still have to deal with Fox. But but mostly, mostly.
So back to your creator-owned work. There's and actually, I guess this is fairly relevant to the work for hire stuff that you're doing with X-Files, because there's often a strong presence of the supernatural or I would even maybe call it magical realism. And for me, as a reader, it elevates Great Pacific from what would otherwise be almost like a political thriller to something that's much more intriguing because it's still very much rooted in a reality I recognize. So much so that I have trouble calling it science fiction, but yet there's a very, I think, probably intentionally delicate balance there with the introduction of these more fantasy elements. Have you had to pull back from going too far into fantasy with Great Pacific?
You know, not overly consciously. I mean, look, you're taking a leap. It becomes speculative fiction once you start imagining the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is a very real, very big problem in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Once you start imagining that as this contiguous mass, this sure. continent of plastic, you know, you've stepped into the surreal, if not, right. you know, the speculative. And because, you know, in reality, for those who don't know, it's pretty much this field of debris and particulate matter that's mostly underneath the surface of the water that's just in very high concentration and it's trapped by oceanic gyres. It's trapped within a gyre, which is a convergence of currents and so on and so forth. So, you know, once you get past the initial fantastic conceit that this thing is essentially, you know, the eighth continent of the world. I do try to keep it grounded. I mean, I do try to throw in stuff that feels very current and real. You know, it deals with geopolitics and you know, the workings of the oil industry and connections that industry has to government and the military and you know, even less overtly, it gets into matters of class and upbringing and
oh absolutely
you know,
and the
legacy
the,
yeah
who the potential allies would be with this kind of fledgling non-nation as they're trying to be recognized by the larger world powers and who they are reaching out to. It feels all of that, like I said, feels very realistic in this kind of larger overlay of, you know, magical giant octopus and so on and so forth. And I don't want to necessarily go to that as like the clear example of, oh, look, you know, Joe Harris is writing fantasy because he's got this magical octopus. I'm not trying to present that as like a kind of cop out. I think that balance, I think you've achieved something really difficult with that balance. And I was just sort of curious if you ever in kind of thinking forward with the story, if it's ever pushing kind of against your instinct to go in one direction or another with that like realism or kind of political awareness with the more fantasy elements. But it sounds like it comes very naturally.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it comes very naturally. I think some of the bigger concepts and elements of Great Pacific, like you mentioned, the giant octopus, Yalathath, who I mean, that's informed, that entire idea is informed by some very, very real things, and we get to do Jules Verne as a as a result of it. Octopuses are, which is, I've learned, is the actual plural of octopus, not octopi, which was, yeah, I know, right? But octopuses. So octopuses are incredibly intelligent creatures. They, you know, so they are remarkably smart. I mean, so much so that they've been surveilled, they've been videotaped waiting until their handlers leave the room, and they've learned how to open up tanks and essentially climb out and go to another tank to get food, then climb back into the original tank so that they think they won't be caught, not realizing they're being videotaped. So in doing a lot of research on what is a really remarkable creature, you know, that sort of then gets informed by, well, what would all the pollution in this place do to something like that? And how would, you know, you can immediately start to imagine the idea of this giant kraken-like creature that also has, you know, its intelligence amplified and its emotions amplified a bit, so that the idea of it forming some sort of emotional bond with our protagonist, Chaz, starts to become something that's really cool to explore. You know, plus we get to have some naval battle where its giant tentacles are grabbing at ships and... Yeah, so I mean, it does come pretty easily, you know, pretty naturally to me. But I can see how you're breaking it down, and I would agree.
Awesome, thanks. it's very analogous back to the political climate of the story. It's taking something that's rooted in reality, like you said, like the octopus is an incredibly intelligent creature, and then just kind of magnifying it a little bit in a way that is slightly outside of the norm and definitely in the fantasy realm, but I've never read a moment of the book and felt like, nope, not in this world. This doesn't make sense. There's a consistency with what you're playing with that I really appreciate.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Can I push you a little bit on the politics part?
Sure.
Have we seen evidence of your own political views making their way into this book specifically?
I think that you can't do a book, you can't tell a story about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch and not adopt a political stance, no matter how high a soapbox you want to get on or not, I would say, because there's no way you can explore an environmental catastrophe like what we're doing to the oceans and not, I mean, there is no, to me, it would be pure propaganda to somehow make a story that, to somehow create something that dealt with this subject matter that presented it as though it was A-okay, you know? So in presenting the reality of it, you know, there's a saying, and this, you know, thematically, that's not what this book is about, but the truth is anti-war. Have you ever heard that term?
Yes.
Just this idea that if you're gonna show this, the human reaction to the reality, I'm counting on when people read it. Now, I made I did make a deliberate decision not to preach, not because I was afraid of turning off any potential readers that don't share my own political viewpoint, because generally I don't care. You know, I like anyone who follows me on social media for not very long probably knows what it is my political positioning is in the spectrum. But that said, I also like creating something challenging, and I wanted to create a protagonist that didn't preach, who was in it primarily for himself. He's in it for the good of the world just enough that I think he's a good enough guy. But he very much sees himself. I've always been fascinated by industrialists, from, you know, J.P. Morgan to Andrew Carnegie, and that's very much who Chaz Worthington sees himself as, the sort of one of, you know, generational figure who, with a vision and enough megalomania to believe that when he executes it, it's going to move all of us forward. Of course, those are the guys that, you know, don't always think about the body count they leave in their wake, but.
But if you add enough of a sort of philanthropic influence to the larger action, then I guess it sort of tempers the little people when they get trampled on.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Bruce Wayne would be the ultimate good version of this character, in that sure. I have a hard time believing Bruce Wayne is ever going to do something consciously that undermines his own values.
He also doesn't involve himself in Wayne Tech very much, or Wayne Enterprises, so he always seems to be discovering, like, we're doing what kind of thing? Yeah. On the day-to-day of his business, I don't think he cares that much in a way.
Well, I mean...
I think there's something about Chaz actually having some of the, I mean, the ideas are coming from him. Sure, he has scientists and he has employees and so on and so forth, but like, he's got vision. He's not just the money.
Mm-hmm.
That puts him in a precarious position of, you know, the balance between what is his motivation and how much is he doing this for him versus how much is he doing this for the planet? And, mm-hmm. I actually think that's super awesome, because he's much more complicated than if you were just out there trying to save the ocean.
That was my, you know, idea from the beginning. And I always tell people, you know, we're not campaigning to get everybody to start recycling.
Right. Which you should do anyway, but still.
That would be awesome. I wish I could affect that. If one person listening to this podcast starts separating their trash better, that's awesome. Good on you. But
that is your legacy.
Yes, exactly. Thank you for separating the paper from the plastic. Uh-huh. That's awesome. But you know, just first and foremost, we've got to be entertaining. And I really wanted to tell a story about a complex character who was not necessarily a mouthpiece for my own viewpoints, even though I'm sure we're similar enough that we probably sound alike often. You know, I think he's hard to categorize. He's not going to, you know, he's not the type of character that's going to espouse some Ayn Randian sort of brand of libertarianism. I don't think he's looking for followers, and he doesn't really have or rather I should say he's not really in a peer group that I think he feels connected to. He thinks he's doing the right thing. He just thinks he's the answer to the problem.
Is it right? Is this sort of a commentary too on the kind of generational you know, this new generation of industrialist, you know, that maybe the children of old money like Chaz that can't break away from that megalomania. It's almost ingrained in their DNA at this point, but mm-hmm. still with altruistic intentions.
Yeah, I think that there's something to that too. I've thought about that a little bit too. I mean, he is very much I don't know if I really like this term, but I guess he is a millennial.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain expectations of that generation that I'd like to believe people of means and talent probably feel angry about, that they mm-hmm. they're not serious, that they don't work hard, that they and I'd like to think that some of that, even if it wasn't completely conscious as we were creating this character, that chip is on his shoulder, I do think too.
Yeah.
He's got something to prove. He certainly has the means to do it.
Yeah.
And for him, I think that there are expectations that were placed on him from a very young age that he has sought to transcend. And I would say that you're going down the right path with mm-hmm. that analysis.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's also kind of it's the kind of thing that makes me think of, can we ever really break the patterns that, you know, of our past, or can we just kind of refocus the energy in the best ways we can, you know, like mm-hmm. where somebody like him, who grew up wealthy beyond belief from money that is, you know, was built upon kind of the blood of the earth in a way,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know, he'll never be able to break that cycle, but maybe he can do something with the energy and the money in order to, you know, maybe change the world, I guess, you know, for the better.
Or will he find himself pulled back into that pattern, like it's
right.
something you can't escape from, like gravity? That's where the interesting yeah. tension comes in
yeah.
for me.
And if he actually can recognize whether he is part of the problem or part of the solution.
Right.
And I think that, I mean, it comes across as very authentic. And I think millennial is not the worst way to describe him. And we've talked about that before, just from an education standpoint, that push and pull, that tug with that entire generation of entitlement and yet so much promise. And I mean, he's right there in the midst of it. He just has a lot of means to either fail or succeed at a grandiose level.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have a very serious question now.
Oh, okay.
So imagine you're the manager of your fantasy baseball team. Who plays what position? And you can pick any characters or creators to fill out the roster you want.
Wow. I mean, can I just say Superman does everything and I win like a million to one?
I guess. That's why people complain that baseball's boring, though, because Superman wins every game.
Oh, I guess I'm a Yankee fan, though. See, that's the ideal. But, God.
That says a lot about you. You just want to be on a team that just beats everyone?
I want my team to beat everyone, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
That's ideal for me. I don't have a problem with that, but it's about...
Well, then you can't have just Superman, because Superman would probably have like some sort of moral something in there. Not just wanting to always win, always, right?
If the point is to play, well... I mean, maybe. I don't know what kind of philosophical stuff they're bringing into just the friendly game of baseball.
That's right.
I think Batman would probably be able to escape from any sort of difficult situation, perhaps doing more underhanded things that would come naturally to him than perhaps Superman would be able to conjure up.
He's got pine tar in his glove.
Yeah, I mean, hey, sometimes you got to do what you got to do. Like it's just very, very human feet of clay. And, in terms of who else I would fill out the roster with, I don't know. I'm sure I can come up with any number of badass Jack Kirby creations and maybe throw in a little bit of an Alan Moore written bio just to give them some complexity and make them colorful. Uh-huh.
Yeah. You could have a Miracle Man, like play third base or something.
He would get out of anything, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's acceptable. I mean,
who do you put in right field, though? I mean, who's your just like, we got to put him somewhere?
Well, somebody fast who isn't going to drop the ball. And,
but isn't quite as awesome as who you have.
You know, the Flash would probably be good in right
field. Sure. Okay. There you go.
Yeah, no. I mean, outfielders, don't look past outfielders. I mean, that's where a lot of your offense and that's, you know, all nine people on a baseball diamond are important. So I wouldn't, you know, some of my favorite baseball players played right field, for instance. So
I played right field, and that says that you just put the worst person out in the outfield.
Not in the major leagues.
Well, turns out I didn't play pro ball.
Not yet.
No.
There's still time. Well, who do you put as first base and third base coach? You know, the coaches matter too.
The coaches do matter. I mean, the manager is the most important, and I would put the best tactician I could think of, and the person who best who's that right mix of understanding the odds and is cool under pressure and knows when to trust their gut instincts. So I'm sure you could, I could come up with anyone from who's been in the biggest fights we've ever seen, maybe from, you know, Cyclops or Captain America or, you know, something along those lines, someone who's used to staring down the fire and coming up with big decisions under pressure. That's who you'd put there. In terms of first base and third base coach, you'd want someone, you know, the trusted lieutenant of that person, the person who knows how to get it done for them, the gunny sergeant, and to put it in, you know, cliche war movie sort of thing, the guy who executes the lieutenant's orders.
Mm-hmm. See, that's where I'd probably use like Sergeant Fury as the manager, because he seems like he's always got that contingency plan in place. Uh-huh. And then you could use some of the other Howling Commandos, you know, like put Dum Dum at first or something, you know.
That's a good command structure to think about, yeah.
Yeah, they're already used to working with each other and that sort of thing. They can take orders from each other pretty easily. Well, I like this baseball team. I'd probably watch more baseball if this is how it works.
I don't think I would.
Well,
we can do this with hockey and I'll be fine with it, but nah, I'm not a baseball gal. Sorry, Joe.
I like hockey too.
Oh, well then why didn't we do this for hockey?
I don't know, but again, I go back to, I would put Superman at all the positions if I could. Or, you know, given I mean, I'm in it to win. That's the point. So
I have to respect that, though. At least you're honest. You're putting it out there. You've acknowledged he is your, like, most powerful character. So there we go. It's Superman for everyone.
That's fine. Yeah, there was no wrong answers.
As long as nobody drops kryptonite in the ice, I guess. So
there's always that, you know.
Or something. Well, I think that we are going to wrap this up. Is there any kind of last minute words of wisdom or things that you want to mention quickly that we didn't get a chance to cover?
Wow.
Not to put you on the spot with, like, giving us a soundbite at the end. We can skip this part. If we just want to wrap it up, it's fine.
I like putting people on the spot. This is your moment of legacy. This is where
you already gave him his moment of legacy earlier.
Well, I mean, the legacy continues. I mean, you know, this is the new legends. This is Joe Harris. The legend continues.
Yeah, I don't know. In terms of parting words, all I'll say is, you know, I know what it's. I've been in and out of comics for a while now, and I it never ceases to amaze me. And I feel very, very fortunate that I get to keep doing this now. That I get to I've gotten to essentially come back into this industry and start to carve out a little corner for myself, and build some degree of a following and a fan base, however big or small that is. I'm not really sure how to estimate at this point, but comics never ceases to amaze me. The fans never cease to amaze me. There is no shortage of, it's not always the most, stable business or industry. And there are a lot of challenges, you know, a lot of changes that seem to happen daily in terms of just the way this market reacts and the way something that's viable one moment suddenly isn't the next, and the competition is fierce, and there's no shortage of people who are talented enough to do every single thing that gets published out there. But I find it an overwhelmingly positive place to work, and an incredibly wonderful place to aspire to do more stuff. And it just never ceases to amaze me, and I feel incredibly lucky to be a part of it.
It's great to hear that you have that positive attitude, as well as the kind of teasing of this big stuff you have on the horizon that you mentioned at the top of the interview. So I think putting those two together, it fills me with a lot of joy to look forward to what we can expect to see from you this year and into next year.
I am full of joy to have filled you with joy.
Aw, see, Superman and joy for everyone. There you go.
This is the legacy of Joe Harris.
That's fine. You can put that on my tombstone.
Aw, Superman and joy?
Fine by me.
Uh-huh. You heard it here first. Well, thanks so much, Joe, for joining us on the couch this week. And thanks to everyone for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop and subscribe to them digitally. Show notes and other details are on our site, as always, on comicstherapy.com. Until next week, we'll talk to you later. You all know me and we're scared as hell. He comes to me at night after I crawl into bed. He